see where they go, I said. Porcelain's present bucked up my bravery no end, and I was ready to follow the prince to wherever they might take us.
Do you think that's wise? She asked, the whites of her eyes flashing in the light of the candle.
No one knows we're down here. If we fell into a pit or something, we might die before anyone found us.
There are no pits down here, I said. Just a lot of old cellars.
Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. I've been down here hundreds of times.
Which was a lie. Prior to my inquisition, I had been in the cellars just once, with Dogger, when I was 5, hunting for a pair of 18th-century alabaster urns that had been put away at the beginning of the war to protect them from possible air raids. Candle held high, I set off along one of the black passageways. Porcelain could either follow or stay where she was, in the dark shadows between the widely spaced electric bulbs. Needless to say, she followed. I had already formed the theory that the footprints had been made by Brookie Harewood, the late Brookie Harewood, but there was no point in mentioning this to Porcelain, who would probably get the wind up at the very idea of following in a dead man's footsteps. But what on earth could Brookie have been doing in the Buckshaw cellars?
Poachers know all the shortcuts, Father had once said, and again, he was probably right.
As we passed under a low brick archway, I let my mind fly back to the night I had caught Brookie in his midnight prowl of the drawing room. It was hard to believe that had been only 5 days ago. I still had a perfect mental image of our strange interview, which had ended with Brookie warning me against housebreakers who might have their eyes on Father's silver.
"Lot of that going on nowadays, since the war," he had said.
And then I had opened one of the French doors and made it quite clear that I wanted him to leave. No, wait. I had first unlocked the door. The door had been locked when I entered the drawing room, and there was no earthly reason to believe that Brookie had locked it behind him if he had broken into the house from the terrace. He'd have wanted it ready for a quick escape had he been in danger of being caught. It was reasonable, therefore, to assume that Brookie had gained entry to the house by some other route, through the cellars, for instance. And the footprints now before us, disappearing into the darkness, quite clear impressions of a fisherman's gumboots, now that I stopped to think about it, suggested that my assumption was correct.
Come on, I said, sensing that Porcelain was hanging back. Stay close behind me.
I thought I heard a little whimper, but I may have been wrong. We had passed the end of the string of electric lights and were now in an arched passageway lined on both sides with piles of decaying furniture. Here the footprints, more than one set of them, but all made by the same pair of boots, revealed that they had ventured more than once into, and out of, Buckshaw. The most recent prints were razor sharp, while the older impressions were softened slightly by the incessant sifting of dust.
"What's that?" Porcelain cried, seizing my shoulder with a painful grip.
Ahead of us, a shrouded object half blocked the passage.
"I don't know," I said. "I thought you'd been down here hundreds of times," she whispered.
"I have," I told her, "but not in this particular passage." Before she could question me, I reached out, took hold of the corner of the sheet, and yanked it away. A cloud of dust went billowing up, blinding us both, making us choke as if we had been caught in a sudden sandstorm.
"Ooh," Porcelain wailed. "It's only dust," I said, even though I was stifling. "And then the candle guttered and went out."
I gave a silent curse and felt in my pocket.
"Hold this," I said, finding her hands in the darkness and wrapping her fingers round the candlestick. "I'll have it going in a jiff."
I dug deeper into my pocket.
"Drat! Bad luck," I said. "I think I left the matches in the pantry."
I felt the candlestick being shoved back into my hands. After a brief moment, there was a scraping sound and a match flared up brightly.
"Good job I thought to pick them up then," Porcelain said, applying the match to the candle.
As the flame grew taller and more steady, I could see the object over which the sheet had been draped.
"Look," I said, "it's a sedan chair."
The thing looked like an early closed-in motor car whose wheels had been stolen. The wood panelling was painted light green with hand-drawn flowers clustered in the corners. The gold medallion on the door was the Deleuze crest. Inside the chair, fleur-de-lis wallpaper had peeled away and hung down in tongues upon the green velvet padding of the seat. There was an odd musty smell about the chair, and it wasn't just mice. To think that some of my own ancestors had sat in this very box and been borne by other humans through the streets of some 18th-century city. I wanted nothing more than to climb inside and become part of my family's history. Just to sit, and nothing more. "This is owned by a woman," Porcelain said in a slow, strange voice that sounded, more than anything, like an incantation. "Silk dress, powdered wig, white face, and a black spot, like a star, on her cheek. She wants..."
"Stop it!" I shouted, spinning round to face her. "I don't want to play your stupid games."
Porcelain stood perfectly still, staring, black eyes shining madly out of her white face. She was entirely covered with dust, Harriet's flame-coloured dress now faded to an ashen orange in the light of the flickering candle.
"Look at you," she said in a voice that sounded to me accusing. "Just look at you."
I couldn't help thinking that I was in the presence of my mother's ghost. At that moment, a metallic clang came from the passageway ahead, and both of us jumped. It sounded like iron on iron, chains being dragged through the bars of a cage.
"Come on," Porcelain said, "let's get out of here."
"No, wait," I said. "I want to find out what's down here." She snatched the candlestick from my hand and began to move quickly back towards the stairs.
"Either come back with me or stay here alone in the dark."
I had no choice but to follow. Chapter 29. The flame colour began to brighten as soon as I shoved the material into the beaker.
"See," I said, "it's working."
"What is that stuff?" Porcelain asked.
"Dry cleaning fluid," I said, giving Harriet's dress a poke with a glass rod and stirring gently. "Carbon tetrachloride, actually." I couldn't say its name without recalling, with pleasure, that the stuff had first been synthesized in 1839 by a Frenchman named Henri Victor Regnault, a one-time upholsterer who had produced carbon tetrachloride through the reaction between chlorine and chloroform. One of the early uses of his invention had been to fumigate barrels of food in which various unpleasant insects had taken up residence. More recently, it had been used to charge fire extinguishers. "Father uses it to scrutinize watermarks on postage stamps," I said. I did not mention that I had recently liberated the bottle from one of his storage cupboards for an experiment involving houseflies.
"Look at the dress. See how clean it is already? A few more minutes and it will be as good as new."
Porcelain, who had wrapped herself in one of my old dressing gowns, looked on in awe. I had changed into a cleanish dress and left the dusty one soaking in one of the laboratory sinks. Later, I would hang it from one of the gas chandeliers to dry.
"You Deleuzes are a strange lot," Porcelain said.
"Ha! Less than an hour ago, you thought that at least two of us were ladylike young women."
"That was before you showed me the cellars."
I noted that our little tour of the Chamber of Horrors had changed her mind.
"Speaking of cellars," I told her, "I'm not easily frightened, but I didn't much care for that stuff about the lady who owned the sedan chair."
"It wasn't stuff. I was telling you what I saw."
"Saw? You're asking me to believe that you saw a woman in a powdered wig in a silk dress?"
For someone with a scientific mind, like me, this was hard to swallow. I had still not decided what to make of Brookie Harewood's grey lady of Buckshaw, or Fenella's cold woman who wanted to come home from the mountain. To say nothing of the pixies. Did everyone take me for a gullible fool? Or were there really other worlds just beyond our range of vision?
In a way, yes, Porcelain said. I saw her with my mind.
This I could understand, at least a little. I could see things with my own mind. The way, for instance, the trimethylamine could be produced by allowing Bacillus prodigiosus to grow on a sample of Mrs. Mullet's mashed potatoes in the heat of a summer afternoon. The resulting blood-red specks, which were known in the Middle Ages as Wunderblut, or strange blood, and which for a whole week in 1819 had appeared on various foods at Padua, would release not only the smell of ammonia, but also the unmistakable odour of trimethylamine. When you come right down to it, I suppose, there is no great difference between ghosts and the invisible worlds of chemistry. I was glad I had remembered dear old trimethylamine, my chemical friend with the fishy smell. I had discussed it with Dogger several days ago and formed certain opinions which I had been prevented from acting upon. It was time now to pick up the threads and follow them wherever they might lead.
I'm tired, I told Porcelain, yawning vastly.
5 minutes later we were tucked up in bed, one of us drifting rapidly towards oblivion. I waited until she was asleep, then slipped quietly out of bed. It was just past midnight when I eased shut my bedroom door and crept silently down the curving staircase. I remembered that Dogger kept a high-powered torch in the butler's pantry for what he called midnight emergencies, and it took only a moment to find it. No frail candle this time, I thought. I had at my fingertips sufficient power to light up the palace pier at Brighton. I hoped it would be enough. The cellars seemed colder than I had remembered. I should have worn a sweater, but it was too late now. I was quickly at the point where the electric bulbs ended, beyond them a cavernous blackness that led who knew where. I switched on the torch and pointed it along the passageway. Far ahead, I could see the outline of the sedan chair. I no longer relished the thought of climbing into the thing and recalling days gone by. In fact, I would be relieved to get past it. "There is no lady," I said aloud, and to my relief, there wasn't. Ahead, the passage took a slight shift to the right. Since I had essentially set off to the right from the bottom of the kitchen stairs, I was heading east, now a little southeast, towards the Visto and the Poseidon Fountain. The gumboot footprints were easy to follow now, no longer overprinted with Porcelain's and mine. There were several sets, I noted, three coming and two going. If, as I suspected, they were Brookies, he had made his first trip to steal one of the fire dogs, his second to return it and make off with the second. On his last visit, he had left by way of the French doors. A sudden cold draught swept past me. Good job I'd brought the torch. The candle would certainly have blown out. With the draught came a dark and a dank odour, an odour I could not at once identify, but one which suggested the reservoirs of neglected water closets, green corrosion with more than a whiff of zinc. Well, I thought, I'm not afraid of zinc, and green corrosion is something that has always interested me. I pushed on. When I had been down here earlier with Porcelain, I had heard a definite metallic clank, but now the passage, which had begun to narrow, was as silent as the tomb. In front of me was an archway with an open door, beyond which, or so it seemed, was a room. I took two careful steps down into the chamber and found myself surrounded on all sides with metal pipes, zinc pipes, lead pipes, iron pipes, bronze pipes, copper pipes, pipes running up, down, and across, all interconnected with right elbows and great metal bolts, with here and there a huge valve like the steering wheel of a motor car. I was at the very heart of Lucius de Luce's subterranean waterworks. and then I heard it, a metallic clanking that echoed round and round the chamber. I'll admit it, I froze. Another clank.
Hello, I called, my voice shaking. Is anyone there?
From somewhere came another sound, an animal sound for certain, though whether it was human, I could not tell. What if a fox had made its way into the tunnel? Or a badger? If that was the case, it would likely run away from a human with a torch.
But what if it didn't? Hello, I called again. Is anyone there?
Again, a muffled sound, weaker. Was it farther away, or was I imagining things? One thing was certain, it could only be coming from somewhere behind a giant pipe that rose up out of the stonework, levelled off, bent 90 degrees, and headed off towards the far side of the chamber. I scrambled up onto the thing, straddled it for a moment, then dropped down on the other side. The passageway into which the pipe led was lower, narrower, and damp. Moisture beaded on the walls, and the floor, between bricks, was wet earth. Just ahead, the tunnel was blocked by an iron gate that was chained shut and locked on the other side with a large, old-fashioned padlock. I gave the thing a rattle, but it was absolutely solid. Without a key, there wasn't a hope of getting past.
Damn, I said. Damn and double damn.
Flavia, someone croaked.
I must admit that I came very close to disgracing myself. I shone the beam through the bars and picked out a shape huddled on the ground. For as long as I live, I shall never forget his white face staring up at me, blinded by the torch's beam. He had managed, somehow, to lose his spectacles, and his pale eyes, blind and blinking, were those of a baby mole pulled from its hole and dragged out suddenly into the daylight.
Colin, I said. Colin Prout?
Turn it off, he pleaded in a ragged voice, twisting away from the light.
I swung the torch away so that the passage beyond the bars was once more in near darkness.
Help me, Colin said, his voice pitiful. I can't. The gate is locked.
I gave the massive thing a shake with one hand, hoping it would spring open, perhaps by some as-yet-undiscovered magic. But that did not happen.
Try it from your side, I told him. There might be a latch.
I knew, even as I said it, that there wasn't, but anything was worth a try.
Can't,
Colin said, and even in the darkness I could tell that he was on the verge of tears.
I'm tied up.
Tied up?
It seemed impossible, even though I had once or twice been in the same position myself.
I've got the key, though. It's in me pocket.
Praise be, I thought. Finally, a bit of luck.
Wiggle yourself over to the gate, I said. I'll try to reach the key. There was a painful silence, and then he said,
I'm tied to something.
And he began to whimper. It was enough to make a saint spit. But wait, the padlock was on Colin's side of the gate, wasn't it? I had noticed this, but not given it my proper attention.
Did you lock yourself in? I asked.
No,
Colin snuffled.
Then how did you get in there?
We come through the door in the fountain.
A door in the fountain?
We? I chose to ask the most important question first.
Who's we, Colin? Who did this to you?
I could hear him breathing heavily in the darkness, but he did not answer. I realized at once the futility of it all. I was not about to spend the rest of my life trying to pry answers out of a captive from whom I was separated by a wall of iron bars.
All right, then, I said. It doesn't matter. Tell me about the door in the fountain. I'll come round and let you out. It made me furious, actually, to think that I should have to ask a stranger about a secret door at Buckshaw. And secret it must be, for I had never heard of such a thing myself.
Such mysteries were surely meant to be handed down by word of mouth from one family member to another, not practically pried from a near stranger who skulked about the countryside in the company of a poacher.
"Simon's toe," Colin said.
"What? You're not making any sense."
The sound of sobbing told me there was no more to be got from him.
"Stay here," I said,
although it made no sense. "I'll be back before you know it."
"No, wait,"
he cried.
"Give me the torch. Don't leave me alone."
"I have to, Colin. I need the torch to light my way."
"No, please. I'm afraid of the dark."
"Tell you what," I said. "Close your eyes and count to 550. It won't be dark with your eyes closed. When you finish, I'll be back. Here, I'll help you start. 1, 2, 3.
"Can't,"
Colin interrupted.
"I haven't learnt me hundreds."
"All right then, let's sing. Come on, we'll sing together." "God save our gracious king, long live our noble king, long may he..."
"Come on, Colin, you're not singing."
"Don't know the words." "All right then, sing something you know. Singing will make me come back sooner." There was a long pause, and then he began in a cracked and quavering voice.
"London Bridge is falling down. Falling down, falling down, London Bridge is falling down."
I turned round and began to pick my way carefully back along the passage, the sound of Colin's voice soon becoming no more than a faint echo. Leaving him there, alone in the darkness, was one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do, although I can't say why. Life is full of surprises like that. The return journey seemed endless. Time had surely slowed as I made my way back beneath the low, arched ceilings to the cellars. Up the steps I went and into the kitchen. Although the house was in perfect silence, I paused anyway to listen at the door. Nothing. Technically, I knew I was not being disobedient. I had been forbidden to leave home, and I had no intention of doing so. The Poseidon Fountain was well within the bounds of Buckshaw, which allowed me to have my cake and jolly well eat it too. I slipped quietly out the back door, leaving it unlocked, and into the kitchen garden. Overhead, the stars twinkled like a million mad eyes, while the moon, already halfway to its first quarter, hung like a broken silver fingernail in the night sky. Ordinarily, even though it wasn't far to the Poseidon Fountain, I'd have taken Gladys with me, if only for company. But now, when a single one of her excited squeaks or rattles might awaken the household, I simply couldn't risk it. I set out at a brisk walk through the wet grass, across the east lawn, towards the visto. Somewhere, an owl hooted, and something tiny scurried through the dead leaves. Then suddenly, almost without warning, Poseidon was looming above me, odd angles of his metal anatomy catching the starlight as if some ancient part of the galaxy had fallen to Earth. I climbed up the steps to the base. What was it Colin had said? Simon's toe? Yes, that was it. But what had he meant? Of course, Poseidon's toe. He must have heard the name from Brookie and got it muddled. I scrambled up onto the fountain's lower bole. Now Poseidon's giant foot was almost in my face, its big toe curled back as if someone were tickling his tummy. I reached out and touched the thing, shoved it down as hard as I could. The toe moved, as if on a hidden hinge, and from somewhere below came a distinct metallic snick. "Simon's toe," I said aloud, smiling and shaking my head, proud of myself for having solved the puzzle. I climbed down to the ground and, yes, there it was. One of the large sculptured panels of water nymphs that form the fountain's decorative base had sprung out slightly from the others. How devilishly clever of old Leaking Deluce to have hidden the lock's release in one of the statue's feet, where it wouldn't be easily discovered. The hatch swung open with a groan, and I stepped carefully into the fountain's base. As I had suspected it might, a single lead pipe emerged from one of several grottos below and bent up sharply to feed water to the fountain. A large arm valve was obviously meant to control the flow, and although a heavy covering of cobwebs told me that it had not been used for ages, I was surrounded by the sound of dripping water, which echoed unnervingly in the dankness of the confined chamber. A dozen precarious steps led down into a wide rectangular pit at the bottom of the fountain. They were splattered with blood. On the edge of the bottom step was a large stain, while diminishing dribbles marked the ones higher up. The blood had been here for some time, as was evident from its brown, well-oxidized appearance. This must be the spot where Brookie met his death. Avoiding the splotches, I picked my way gingerly to the bottom. The pit was surprisingly spacious. To one side, overhead, an iron grating revealed slits of the night sky, the stars still shining brightly, giving off so much light, in fact, that even the towering outline of Poseidon himself was visible far above. Gaping upwards at this novel viewpoint, I somehow managed to misstep. I twisted my ankle. "Damn!" I said, pointing the torch at the ground to see what had caused my injury. It was a rope, and it lay coiled in the circle of light like a self-contented viper sunning itself after a particularly satisfying lunch. I can't say that I was surprised, since I had already deduced that there would likely be a rope. I had simply forgotten about it until I tripped on the stupid thing. What was surprising, though, was that the police had not discovered such a crucial bit of evidence, a surprising misstep, not only for me, but also for them. Better not touch it, I thought. Best leave it in place for Inspector Hewitt's men. Besides, I already knew as much as I needed to know about this particular remnant of the crime. With a couple of halting steps, I limped towards an open tunnel. But wait, which of these openings would lead me back to Colin? The one on the left, I thought, although I could hardly be sure. Lucius Deluce's plan had shown a bewildering maze of subterranean waterworks, and only now that I thought about it did I remember shoving the folded map into my pocket. I grinned, realizing that help was right here at my very fingertips. But when I reached for it, my pocket was empty. Of course, I had changed my dusty dress for a clean one, and I let slip a mental curse as I realized that Lucius's priceless hand-drawn map was, at this very moment, soaking its way to blankness in a laboratory sink. There was nothing for it now but to follow my instincts and choose a tunnel, the one on my left. Here at its eastern extremity, the corridor was not only lower and more narrow, but had fallen into scandalous disrepair. The brick walls and pieces of the roof had crumbled in places, covering parts of the floor with broken rubble. Careful, I thought, the whole thing might cave in and... Something slapped my face, something dangling from the roof like a dead white arm. I let out a little yelp and stopped in my tracks. A root. I had been frightened by a stupid root that had been put down, perhaps by one of the long-gone borders which had, in earlier times, shaded the walkways of the visto. Even though I ducked under the thing, its slimy finger still managed to caress my face, as if it were dying for want of human company. I limped along, the light of the torch sweeping wildly in front of me. Here, on both sides of the tunnel, a dusty assortment of ladders, ropes, pails, watering cans and galvanized funnels had been left, as if the groundskeepers who had used them had wandered off to war and forgotten to return. A sudden flash of red brought me to a stop. Someone had written on the wall. I let the light play slowly over the painted letters. H.D.L. Harriet Deluce. My mother had been here before me, found her way through this same tunnel, stood on these same bricks, painted her initials on the wall. Something like a shiver overtook me. I was surrounded with Harriet's presence. How, when I had never known her, could I miss her so deeply? Then, faintly, from far along the tunnel, there came to my ears the sound of a voice, singing.
London Bridge is falling down, my fair lady.
Colin, I shouted, and suddenly my eyes were brimming.
Colin, it's me, Flavia.
I lurched forward, tripping over fallen stones, feeling the ooze in my shoes from the tunnel's seepage. My hands were raw from clutching at the rough wall for support. And then, there he was.
My fair lady, he was singing.
It's all right, Colin. You can stop now. Where's the key? He winced at the light, then stared at me with a strange, offended look.
Untie me first, he said gruffly.
No, key first, I said. That way you won't run off with it. Colin groaned as he rolled slightly onto his left side. I reached into his pocket, and pulled out an iron key. As he twisted, I could see that Colin's wrists were bound firmly behind him and lashed to an iron pipe that rose up vertically before vanishing into the roof. The poor creature could have been tied up here for days.
You must be in agony, I said,
and he looked up at me again with such blank puzzlement that I wondered if he knew the meaning of the word. I struggled with the knots. Colin's efforts to free himself and the moisture from the seeping walls had shrunken them horribly.
Do you have a knife?
Colin shook his head and looked away.
What? No knife? Come on, Colin. Boy Scouts are born with knives. Took it off me. Might hurt yourself. That's what they said.
Never mind then. Lean forward. I'll try the key. Putting the torch on the ground so that its light reflected from the wall, I attacked the knots with the business end of the key. Colin groaned, letting out little yelps every time I applied pressure to his bonds. In spite of the clamminess of the tunnel, sweat was dripping from my forehead onto the already saturated rope.
Hang on, I told him. I've almost got it.
The last end pulled through, and he was free.
Stand up, I said. You need to move around.
He rolled over, unable to get to his feet. Grab hold, I said, offering my hand, but he shook his head.
You have to get your circulation going, I told him. Rub your arms and legs as hard as you can. Here, I'll help you. It's no good, he said. Can't do it.
Of course you can, I said, rubbing more briskly. You need to get some circulation into your toes and fingers. His lower lip was trembling, and I felt a sudden surge of pity.
Tell you what, let's have a rest.
Even in the half-light, his gratitude was hard to miss. Now then, I said, tell me about the blood on the fountain steps. Perhaps it wasn't fair, but I needed to know. At the word blood, Colin shrank back in horror.
I never done it, he croaked.
Never did what, Colin?
Never done Brookie. Never shoved that sticker in his nose.
He roughed you up, didn't he? Left you no choice.
No, Colin said, managing somehow to pull himself to his feet. It weren't like that. It weren't like that at all.
Tell me what happened, I said, surprised by my own coolness in what could prove to be a tricky situation.
We was chums, Brookie and me. He told me stories when we wasn't scrapping.
Stories? What kind of stories?
You know, King Arthur-like. Had some right lovely talks we did. Used to tell me about old Nicodemus Flitch and how he could strike a sinner dead whenever he took the notion.
Was Brookie a hobbler? I asked.
Course not, Colin scoffed, but he wished he was. He fancied their ways, he used to say.
So there it was. I should have asked Colin in the first place.
You were telling me about the sticker,
I said, trying to steer Colin gently back to the moment of Brookie's death.
He showed it to me, Colin said,
ever so pretty, silver, like pirate treasure. Dug it up behind your house, Brookie did. Going to make dozens of them, he said. Enough for a garden party at Buckingham Palace. I dared not interrupt.
Give it here,
I told him. Let's have a gander. Just for a minute, I'll give it back. But he wouldn't. Might stab yourself, he said. Laughed at me.
Here, you promised,
I told him. You said we'd go off as if I carried the dog thing. I grabbed it. Didn't mean nothing by it. Just wanted to have a gander, is all. He grabbed it back and gave it such a tug. I let go too quick and... His face was sheer horror.
I never done it, he said. I never done it.
I understand, I said. It was an accident. I'll do whatever I can to help. But tell me this, Colin.
Who tied you up?
He let out such a wail that it nearly froze my blood, even though I already knew the answer. It was Tom Bull, wasn't it? Colin's eyes grew as round as saucers, and he stared over my shoulder.
He's coming back. He said he'd be back.
Nonsense, I said. You've been here for ages.
Going to do me, Tom Bull is, 'cause I seen what he done at the caravan.
You saw what he did at the caravan?
Heard it anyhow. Heard all the screaming. Then he come out and tossed something in the river. He's going to kill me.
Colin's eyes were wide as saucers. He won't kill you, I told him. If he were, he'd have done it before now. And then I heard the sound behind me in the tunnel. Colin's eyes grew even larger, almost starting from their sockets.
He's here!
I whipped round with the torch to see a hulking form scuttling towards us like a giant land crab, so large that it nearly filled the passageway from roof to floor and from wall to wall. A figure bent over nearly double to negotiate the cramped tunnel. It could only be Tom Bull.
The key,
I shouted, realizing even as I did so that it was in my hand. I sprang for the lock and gave the thing a twist. Damn all things mechanical. The lock seemed rusted solid. No more than a dozen paces away, the huge man was charging along the tunnel towards us, his rasping breath now horribly audible, his wild red hair like that of some raging madman. Suddenly I was shoved aside. Colin snatched the key from my hand.
No, Colin!
He rammed it into the lock, gave it a fierce twist, and the hasp sprang open. A moment later, he had yanked open the gate and pushed me, dragged me, almost carried me through. He slammed shut the gate, snapped the lock closed, and pushed me well away from the bars.
Watch this'un, he said. Him's got long arms.
For a moment, Colin and I stood there, breathing heavily, looking in horror at the blood-engorged face of Tom Bull as it glared at us from behind the iron bars. His great fists grasped the heavy gate, shaking it as if to rip it out by the roots. The Red Bull. Fenella had been right. I jerked back in horror against the wet wall, and as I did so, my twisted ankle gave way and I dropped the torch. We were plunged instantly into inky blackness. I dropped to my knees, feeling the wet floor with outstretched fingers.
Keep clear of the bars, Colin whispered. Elsie'll grab you.
Not knowing which way was which, I scrabbled in the darkness, fearful that at any instant my wrist would be seized. After what seemed like an eternity, the back of my hand brushed against the torch. I closed my fingers around it, picked it up, pushed the switch with my thumb. Nothing. I gave it a shake, banged it with the heel of my hand.
Still nothing.
The torch was broken. I could have wept. Close to me in the darkness, I heard a rustling. I dared not move. I counted 10 heartbeats. Then there came a scraping, and a match flared up.
Had 'em in my pocket, Colin said proudly, all along.
Go slowly, I told him. That way, don't let the match go out. As we backed away from the gate into the tunnel, and Tom Bull's face faded into darkness, his mouth moved and he uttered the only words I ever heard him speak.
Where's my baby?
he cried. His words echoed like knives from the stone walls. In the horrid silence that followed, we edged farther back along the tunnel. When the first match burned out, Colin took out another.
"How many of those do you have?" I asked.
"One more," he said, and he lit it. We had gained some ground, but it was still a long way to the cellars. Colin held his last match high, moving slowly again, leading the way.
"Good lad," I told him. "You've saved us."
A sudden gust of cold air blew out the match, and we were plunged once again into blackness.
"Keep moving," I urged him. "Follow the wall."
Colin froze.
"Can't," he said. "I'm afraid of the dark."
"It's all right," I told him. "I'm with you. I won't let anything happen."
I pushed against him, but he would not be budged.
"No," he said. "Can't."
I could have gone on without him, but I was incapable of leaving him here alone. And slowly, I realized that somehow, even in the darkness, I could dimly see Colin's white face. A moment later, I became aware of a growing light that had suddenly filled the passageway. I spun round, and there, to my amazement, was Dogger, holding a large lantern above his head. Porcelain peered round him, fearfully at first, and then, when she saw I was quite safe, running to me, almost crushing me in her embrace.
"I'm afraid I ratted on you," she said.
Chapter 30. And Dogger, you see, had already latched the door at the fountain. It only opens from the outside, so there was no way Tom Bull could get out.
"Well done, Dogger," Father said.
Dogger smiled and gazed out the drawing-room window. Daffy shifted uneasily on the Chesterfield. She'd been torn away from her book by Father, who insisted that both she and Feely be present at the interview. It was almost as if he was proud of me. Feely stood at the chimney-piece, pretending to be bored, stealing quick, greedy glances at herself in the looking-glass, while otherwise simpering at Sergeant Graves.
"This whole business about the hobblers is intriguing," Inspector Hewitt said. "Your notes have been most helpful."
I fizzed a little inside.
"I gather they've been carrying out their baptisms in the gully since sometime in the 17th century?"
I nodded. "Mrs. Bull wanted her baby baptized in the old style, and her husband, I think, probably forbade it."
"That he did," said Sergeant Graves. "He's told us as much."
The inspector glared at him. "She went to the gully with Miss Mountjoy. Dr. Kissing saw them together. There might have been other hobblers present, but I really don't know. But something went horribly wrong. They were dipping the baby by the heel, as hobbler tradition requires, when something happened. The baby slipped and drowned. They buried it in the parlings, swore to keep the truth to themselves. At least, I think that's what happened." Sergeant Graves nodded, and the inspector shot him such a look. "Mrs. Bull thought at once of blaming it on Fenella. After all, she had just passed the caravan in the lane. She went home and told her husband, Tom, that their baby had been taken by gypsies. And he believed her, has gone on believing her, until now." I took a deep breath and went on. "Fenella told Mrs. Bull's fortune at the fete last week, told her the same nonsense she tells everyone, that something was buried in her past, something that wanted digging out." Only at that instant, as I spoke, did the full force, the full aptness of Fenella's words come crashing into my consciousness.
"Told her there was something buried in her past. Told her it wanted digging out, wanted setting right."
I had actually copied these words into my notebook without understanding their meaning. She couldn't possibly have learned of the Ball baby's supposed abduction until later. She had been gone from the gully before the bungled baptism began. Mrs. Ball, to reinforce her lie, must have been forced to follow through by filing a false report with the police. Tom, because of his shady associations, must have managed to keep well in the background. Hadn't Mrs. Mullet let slip that he'd had his troubles with the law. How I wished I could ask the inspector to confirm my conjecture, especially the part about Tom Bull. But I knew he wouldn't, couldn't tell me. Perhaps some other time. At any rate, Fenella had almost certainly been tracked down and questioned by the authorities during their investigation of the missing child. Tracked down, questioned, and cleared. That much seemed obvious. So that when Mrs. Bull had wandered unexpectedly into her tent just last week at the fete, it must have seemed as if fate had sent her there for justice.
There's something buried in your past, something that wants digging out, wants setting right, Fenella had told her. But it was not the baby she meant. It was Mrs. Bull's accusation of kidnapping. Revenge is my specialty, Fenella had said. Revenge indeed, but not without cost. Surely the woman had recognized Fenella's caravan at the fete. Whatever could have possessed her to enter the tent?
I could think of only one reason. Guilt. Perhaps, in her own mind, Mrs. Bull's lie to her husband and the police was beginning to come unraveled. Perhaps in some odd way she believed that a fresh confrontation would deflect any growing suspicion, on Tom's part, of her own guilt. What was it Dr. Darby had told me?
People can behave very strangely in times of great stress.
Well, the inspector said, interrupting my thoughts. He was waiting for me to go on. Well, Mrs. Bull, of course, assumed that Fenella had looked into the crystal ball and seen the drowning. She must have gone home straight away and told her husband that the gypsy who had taken their baby was again camped at the Parlings. Tom went to the caravan that very night and tried to kill her. He still believes his wife's lie, most likely, I added. Even though the baby's body has since been found, I'll bet he's still blaming it on the gypsies. I glanced over at Sergeant Graves for confirmation, but his face was a study in stone. How can you be so sure he was at the caravan? Inspector Hewitt asked, turning to a new page of his notebook. Because Colin Prout saw him there, and, as if that weren't enough, there was that whole business about the smell of fish, I said. I think you'll find that Tom Bull has a disease that causes his body to exude a fishy odour. Dogger says that a number of such cases have been recorded. Inspector Hewitt's eyebrows went up slightly, but he said nothing. That's why, as it's grown worse, he's kept to his house for the past year or more. Mrs. Bull put about the story that he'd gone away, but he'd all the while been right here in Bishop's Lacey, working after dark. He's a foundryman, you know, and probably quite handy at melting down scrap iron and moulding it into antiques.
Yes, Inspector Hewitt said, surprising me. It's no secret that he was once employed at Sampson's Works in East Finching.
And still is, I suggested, at least after dark. Inspector Hewitt closed his notebook and got to his feet.
I'm very pleased to tell you, Colonel, that your fire dogs will soon be restored. We found them in the coach house where Harewood kept his antiques.
I was right. The Sally Fox and Chapeau at Brookie's had been Harriet's. Having replaced them with reproductions, Brookie was just waiting for a chance to sell the originals in London.
There are others involved in what proved to be a very sophisticated ring of thieves and forgers. I trust that, in due time, you'll read about it in the newspapers.
But what about Miss Mountjoy? I blurted it out. I felt quite sorry for poor Tilda Mountjoy.
She may well face charges as an accessory, the inspector said. It's up to the chief constable. I don't envy him his task.
Poor Colin, I said. He hasn't had an easy life, has he?
There may be mitigating circumstances, Inspector Hewitt said. Beyond that, I can say nothing.
I knew for certain he was mixed up in it when I found the rope. I regretted it as soon as the words were out of my mouth.
Rope? What rope?
The rope that fell through the grating at the Poseidon Fountain.
Woolmer? Graves? What do we know about this?
Nothing, sir, they said in unison.
Then perhaps you will favour us by taking yourselves to the fountain immediately and rectifying the oversight. Yes, sir, they said, and marched, red-faced, from the drawing room. The inspector again focused his fierce attention on me. The rope, he said. Tell me about the rope.
There had to be one, I explained. Brookie was far too heavy to be hoisted onto the fountain by anyone but the strongest man, or a Boy Scout with a rope.
Thank you, Inspector Hewitt said. That will do. I'm quite sure we can fill in the blanks.
Besides, I added, the rubbed spot on the trident showed quite clearly where the rope had polished away the tarnish.
Thank you. I believe we've already noted that.
Well then, I thought, you've no one to blame but yourselves if you didn't think of looking for the rope that caused it. Colin is a Boy Scout, for heaven's sake. There were times when officialdom was beyond even me.
One last point, the inspector said, rubbing his nose. Perhaps you'd be good enough to clear up one small question that has rather eluded me.
I'll do my best, Inspector, I said.
Why on earth did Colin hang Brookie from the fountain? Why not leave him where he was?
They had struggled for the lobster pick inside the base of the fountain. When Colin let go of the thing suddenly, Brookie's own force caused him to stab himself in the nostril. It was an accident, of course. Although this was the way Colin had told it to me, I must confess to gilding the lily more than a little for the inspector's benefit. I no more believed Colin's version of the story than I believed that dray horses can fly. Brookie's death, in my estimation, was Colin's revenge for years of abuse. It was murder, pure and simple. But who was I to judge? I had no intention of adding so much as another ounce to the burden of Colin's troubles. Brookie fell backwards down the stone steps into the chamber. That's probably what actually killed him. Oh, Lord, forgive me this one charitable little fib. Colin fetched a length of rope from the tunnel and hauled him up onto Poseidon's trident. He had to tie Brookie's wrist together so that the arms wouldn't slip out of the coat later. He didn't want to risk the body falling. Inspector Hewitt gave me a look I can only describe as sceptical. Brookie, I went on, had told Colin about the hobbler's belief that heaven was right there above our heads. You see, he wanted to give Brookie a head start.
Good Lord, Father said.
Inspector Hewitt scratched his nose.
He said, seems rather far-fetched.
Not so far-fetched at all, Inspector, I said. That's precisely the way Colin explained it to me. I'm sure that when Dr. Darby and the vicar allow you to question him further...
The inspector nodded in a sad way, as if he'd rather suspected it all along. Thank you, Flavia, he said, getting to his feet and closing his notebook. And thank you, Colonel Deluce. You've been more than generous in helping us get to the bottom of this matter.
He walked to the drawing-room door.
Oh,
and Flavia, he said rather shyly, turning back.
I almost forgot. I came here today somewhat as a message-bearer.
My wife, Antigone, would be delighted if you'd come for tea next Wednesday.
If you're free, of course.
Antigone? Tea? And then it sank in. Oh, frabjous day! Calou, Calais, that glorious goddess Antigone was summoning me, Flavia Sabina Deluce, to her vine-covered cottage. Thank you, Inspector, I said primly. I shall consult my calendar and see if I can set aside some time. Up the stairs I flew. I couldn't wait to tell Porcelain. I should have guessed that she'd be gone. She had torn a blank page from my notebook and fastened it to one of my pillows with a safety pin. Thanks for everything. Look me up in London sometime. Your friend, Porcelain. Just that, and nothing more. At first, I was seized with sadness. In spite of our ups and downs, I had never met anyone quite like Porcelain Lee. I had already begun to miss her. I find it difficult to write about the portrait of Harriet.
Leaving the painting at Vanetta Harewood's studio with its face against the wall was out of the question. She had, after all, offered it to me, and since Harriet had paid in full for the work, it belonged rightly to her estate at Buckshaw. I would hang it secretly, I decided, in the drawing room. I would unveil it for my family with as much ceremony as I could muster. I could hardly wait. In the end, it hadn't been terribly difficult to arrange the transfer. I'd asked Mrs. Mallet to have a word with Clarence Mundy, who operated Bishop's Lacey's only taxicab, and Clarence had agreed to lay on transportation, as he put it. On a dark and rainy afternoon in late September, we had rolled up at the gate of the cottage studio in Malden Fenwick, and Clarence had walked me to the door with an oversized black umbrella. "Come in," Vanetta Harewood said. "I've been expecting you." "Sorry we're a bit late," I said. "The rain and so forth."
"It's no trouble at all," she replied. "To be truthful, I've been finding the days rather longer than usual."
Clarence and I waited in the hall until the glowering Ursula appeared with a large object wrapped in brown paper.
"Keep it dry," Vanetta said. "It's my best work."
And so we brought Harriet's portrait to Buckshaw.
"Hold the umbrella for me," Clarence said, preparing to wrestle the package from the back seat of the taxicab. "I'm going to need both hands."
Shielding the parcel from the slanting rain, we dashed to the door, as awkward as three-legged racers. I had handed Clarence the fare and was halfway across the foyer when suddenly Father emerged from his study.
"What have you dragged home now?" he asked,
and I couldn't find it in my heart to lie.
"It's a painting," I said. "It belongs to you."
Father leaned it against the wall and returned to his study, from which he emerged with a pair of shears to cut the several turns of butcher's string. He let the paper fall away.
"That was 2 weeks ago.
The portrait of Harriet and her three children is no longer in the foyer, nor is it in the drawing room. Until today, I'd searched the house in vain. But this morning, when I unlocked the door of my laboratory, I found the painting hanging above the mantelpiece. I've mentioned this to no one. Father knows it's there, and I know it's there. And for now, that's all that counts." Note to the reader. In order to provide sufficiently dramatic lighting for this story, I must admit to having tinkered slightly, here and there, with the phases of the moon, though the reader may rest assured that, having finished, I've put everything back exactly as it was. This is Jane Entwistle. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of A Red Herring Without Mustard, A Flavia de Luce Mystery by Alan Bradley. This programme was directed by Kathy Thornburn. Executive producers, Orly Moskowitz and Janet Stark. Text copyright 2011 by Alan Bradley. Production copyright 2011, Random House Inc. All rights reserved. Audible hopes you have enjoyed.